This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight:
Somalia is experiencing a moment of both tragedy and hope. Tragedy because a drought-induced humanitarian crisis is now engulfing the country with imminent risk of famine. Hope because the recent electoral process has created momentum for fresh political engagement among Somalis.
That's UN Special Representative for Somalia, Michael Keating, addressing the Security Council today. Details next.
Also, floods kill at least 11 people and leave thousands homeless in Angola's northwestern Luanda province. And armed groups are preventing thousands of children in the Central African Republic from getting an education.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story: the UN Security Council was briefed today on the humanitarian crisis in Somalia brought on by drought and conflict. Michael Keating is the Secretary General's Special Representative for Somalia and head of the UN Assistance Millions in Somalia.
Somalia is experiencing a moment of both tragedy and hope. Tragedy because a drought-induced humanitarian crisis is now engulfing the country with imminent risk of famine. Hope, because the recent electoral process has created momentum for fresh political engagement among Somalis. The announcement 48 hours ago of the cabinet, including six women, is another important step forward. Mr. President, over 6 million Somalis, half the total population, are now in need of assistance. Nearly 3 million, mainly women and children, require immediate life-saving support, including growing numbers of displaced people living in miserable conditions. Somalis, including politicians, business people, civil society, and members of the diaspora, are taking responsibility for drought response. This distinguishes Somalia from other countries facing humanitarian catastrophe. President Farmajo has declared a national disaster within days of taking office. He is using all available platforms to mobilize national and international support. Access remains a challenge, including in Al-Shabaab-controlled areas. But compared to 2011, when 260,000 people died, the scope for responding to the crisis is greater.
Keating explained how the response differs from 2011 and what more needs to be done.
Cell phone coverage and money transfer options have expanded. Data on needs and assessment have improved. Controls on resources and partner vetting is stronger, and operational capacities have grown. Humanitarian partners are scaling up the response, including through private sector and cash programming in affected areas. More people are now being reached with food aid, nutritional support, healthcare services, and access to safe water. But much more is needed. The most urgent challenges include funding for immediate life-saving action, in particular for the cholera response, which has now affected 11 of the 18 regions. Treatment centers and units are being opened throughout the country, but the disease continues to spread. Rapid scale-up of treatment and preventive measures are urgently needed before the rains, which will only further exacerbate the problem. The Famine Prevention Operational Plan seeks $825 million to reach 5.5 million people by June. The plan is currently 32% funded. Funding and cash flow constraints prevented a significant increase in response activities at the beginning of the year. More resources are needed by the end of March to enable partners to reach affected people before it is too late.
The UN Special Representative said the recent presidential election in Somalia has wide-ranging positive effects.
The elation that greeted President Farmajo on February the 8th transcended clan and regional lines. The outcome of the process has generated widespread goodwill. As Prime Minister Haile Mariam of Ethiopia said, Somalis have made history and set a great example to countries emerging from conflict. The complexity and imperfections of the electoral process have not diminished expectation that there must be one person, one vote in 2020. Preparations must begin now to establish the necessary legal and administrative framework to lay the groundwork for inclusive elections and to permit women to compete on equal terms to men.
However, Keating said unless Somalia can attract serious investment and generate domestic revenues, state building will remain only an aspiration. He added the country would remain vulnerable to weather-related shocks. Somali President Farmaajo also addressed the Security Council by video link.
The progress made in Somalia is making can be a difficult to meet the challenge of drought and humanitarian crisis, both in our country and within the region. But we must not forget it and give way to simply doom and gloom. We in Somalia strongly believe that socioeconomic and political gain must go hand in hand with good governance to achieve sustainable development for all our people.
The Somali president pledged to defeat the al-Shabaab terrorist group, but he said the only way to truly ensure Somalia's security is to rebuild the national army. Also today, the Security Council voted to extend the mandate of the UN assistance mission in Somalia until June.
A new climate study from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology predicts a hotter planet over the course of the 21st century will mean increased drought in sub-Saharan Africa. That will lead to a dramatic reduction in the production of maize, the continent's most important staple crop. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Amy Dale, the study's lead author. Dale is an environmental engineering and public policy expert with MIT's Department of Earth, Atmospheric and Planetary Sciences.
We had a couple goals in mind when we did this. One of them was just to sort of understand the what we would call the median change, sort of what is the most likely outcome under climate change for maize production. But we were also really interested in the uncertainty in those predictions, because we have many global models of changes in climate in the future, and each of those models makes a slightly different prediction. And so we wanted to sort of paint a map of Africa in the future and where we might be able to make some solid decisions now, and where we might also still have a lot of uncertainty that needs to get resolved to help us make decisions.
What kind of decisions do you want to make?
Infrastructure and investment planning in the future under climate change, thinking about things like expansion of irrigation, perhaps irrigation infrastructure, hydropower development, infrastructure and investment planning under climate change, these kinds of questions that we have about how we can ensure a food secure future and also help Africa meet its many needs going forward over the next many decades.
When you talk about climate change, you're talking about heating up of the climate and also the amount of rainfall, correct? I mean, isn't that what's related to maize production?
Yes, we have under climate change global increases in temperature. We also have shifts in precipitation or rainfall patterns. In some cases, those effects will be in the same direction in terms of how they impact maize production. In some cases, they may have opposite effects. And so we'll see regional trends across the continent, mostly negative impacts on maize production. But in some small regions throughout Africa, we actually do see the opposite of potential increases in maize production as well.
Now, maize production is dependent upon rainfall. And if there's a drought, which I assume that your climate model also predicts, that means less corn, right?
That's exactly right. In Africa, most of the maize production across the continent is rain-fed. So there isn't a lot of reliance on irrigation. What this means is that as we see changes in precipitation, along with increases in temperature, there isn't perhaps as much resilience to those rainfall changes as we might see in a region with a lot of irrigation. So it makes it quite sensitive to changes in climate. So the combination can be quite bad.
What was the aspect of the study that fascinated you the most? In terms of your own area of comfort and expertise, did you have any oh wow moments during this study?
I was surprised by how large some of these changes are anticipated to be in particular regions of Africa. I mean, we have countries like Zambia and South Africa where we're anticipating losses of maize production of 20% or larger median. And that's quite severe. We have particular grid cells within the model. These are sort of subregions that we average over to get national estimates or regional estimates, where we're seeing greater than 50% declines in the maize production. So this is really quite serious.
This is directly relevant to food scarcity and food security. All this is really important for how Africans eat.
Yes. I mean, maize is the most calorically important crop in sub-Saharan Africa. And so this has a direct implication for these populations, a large fraction of which rely on subsistence farming. So we're talking about a region of the world that has almost a quarter of the world's malnourished population. And so this is a very serious problem for food security going forward.
That was environmental engineering and policy expert Amy Dale of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
After 5 years of drought, Angola is now getting too much rain. AFP reports floods have killed at least 11 people and left thousands homeless in northwestern Luanda province. At least 700 homes have been destroyed. The heavy rains began Tuesday. Officials warn that reservoirs on the outskirts of Luanda are near capacity and could overflow soon. And the soil is saturated and cannot absorb any more water. Many roads are underwater, especially in rural areas. A lot of people are traveling by canoes provided by emergency services.
A human rights organization says armed groups in Central African Republic have occupied, looted, and damaged hundreds of schools, preventing thousands of children from getting an education. VOA's Jody Kapowa has the story.
A new Human Rights Watch report entitled No Class says Seleka rebels, anti-Balaka militias, and even UN peacekeeping troops have used school buildings as barracks or bases. Louis Mudge is an Africa researcher for the group.
Approximately 20% of the schools right now in the CAR are not functioning. And the reasons given for most of those schools not functioning have to do with the conflict, whether that be schools that were damaged by fighters' occupation, schools that were attacked, or students and teachers who are just afraid to go to school due to the proximity of fighters nearby.
Mudge explains why armed groups prefer occupying schools.
In many, many towns and villages across the country, schools are the best buildings. They have concrete floors. They have good metal roofs. The walls are usually pretty solid. So for a rebel group that came into town, this makes perfect sense as a place to take over. What's more is that schools most of the time are based along the principal road, which gives them access to stopping traffic. So it's a natural place for these rebel groups to set up a road barrier.
Fighters often burn school books and furniture to cook their meals. Mudge says that children have lost years of education in many parts of CAR because armed groups fail to treat schools as places of learning and sanctuaries for children.
In some of the towns we found, this problem has been going on since the Seleka took over. So that was in Bangui, March of 2013, but in other parts of the country, this was in late 2012. The Seleka began their offensive in late 2012.
The mostly Christian and animist anti-Balaka militias were formed to wage revenge attacks against the mostly Muslim Seleka rebels. Mudge says school occupations in CAR could increase soon.
What we found is that a lot of these occupations are seasonal. Right now, the dry season is coming to a close in the Central African Republic, and the rains are going to start. And what we were told pretty openly by fighters was that, yeah, once the rain starts, we'll move back into the school because we don't want to get wet.
The government signed the Safe Schools Declaration in mid-2015, committing itself to protecting schools. The UN mission then began clearing schools that were occupied. But last year, its own forces were found inside schools.
We were very surprised to find that. This is in direct violation of the Safe Schools Declaration that was signed by the national government, but also in violation of a directive that was issued by MINUSCA, the peacekeeping mission, in late 2015 on this issue. The directive is very, very clear. It says, under no circumstances are soldiers from the UN mission to occupy schools.
Mudge says, however, when informed of what some peacekeeping troops were doing, the UN took immediate action to end it. He says, unless MINUSCA prevents armed groups from occupying schools, there may be a lost generation of students, those who have missed years of education and are not able to recover. Not much help is expected from CAR's year-old government. It has very little power outside the capital, Bangui, where most of the violence and fighting is taking place. The government is struggling to maintain order and relies heavily on international assistance. The Human Rights Watch report has been released prior to the second International Safe Schools Conference. It's being held in Buenos Aires, March 28th and 29th. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib. 21 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. The UN Security Council was briefed today on the humanitarian crisis in Somalia. Floods kill at least 11 people and leave thousands homeless in Angola's northwestern Luanda province. And armed groups are preventing thousands of children in the Central African Republic from getting an education. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
At least 10 Egyptian soldiers and 15 militants are reported dead in the central Sinai after police raided a hideout today. An army spokesman says the soldiers were killed by roadside bombs as their vehicles tried to chase the militants. He says seven militants have been arrested. Egypt is fighting an insurgency in northern Sinai for many years, mostly against an affiliate of the Islamic State. Reports say Egyptian troops have destroyed large amounts of explosives in the raid and seized weapons, ammunition, and equipment. The Associated Press says even though the fighting is hundreds of kilometers from Red Sea tourist destinations, tourism has sharply declined due to fear of terrorist attacks. In October 2015, a bomb caused a Russian airliner full of tourists to crash. All 224 people on board were killed.
The head of United Nations Support Mission in Libya, Martin Kobler, warns of a dangerous escalation of conflict across the country. He says it's due to the deteriorating security situation in Tripoli and recent events in Misrata and Benghazi. Among those following developments is Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of Libya Analysis in London. She spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi about Kobler's warning.
I think this warning is serious because actually the situation in Libya has become quite serious. Whereas before, different political groups and factions did clash and there were hostilities. However, there was also a certain amount of political posturing and decision-making, and therefore there was a certain amount that political solutions could have. However, what we're seeing now is that the situation has become far more militarized, with clashes taking place on the ground without any of the sort of political background. And the danger is that, therefore, the only solution may become, if the situation escalates, a military solution. And the problem with that is that no one power or faction in Libya actually has the military capacity to control all of Libya. So I think what we're likely to see is an ongoing tug of war between different groups going backwards and forwards, and that will only contribute to further instability and a deterioration of the security situation for the whole country.
The special representative appealed to the Libyan institutions to commit to advancing the Libyan political agreement and swiftly achieve the withdrawal of armed groups from the capital and the deployment of army and police forces. Would Libyan rivals abide by this call?
No. The issue with armed groups in Libya is actually the root of a lot of Libya's problems since 2011. And therefore, although the sentiment of this statement is correct, that is ultimately what Libya needs, I don't think there's any way we're going to see that in the next few days, weeks, or even months, as finding a way to control and get the withdrawal of these armed groups is actually a lot of what the political dialogue and talks have been trying to achieve. So even in Tripoli, for example, where militias who are nominally allied with the UN-backed Government of National Accord have driven some other militias out, they haven't done that because they themselves then want to put down their arms. You know, they now have control of large swathes of Tripoli, so even the sort of non-rival groups will not want to have the army or police come in. And the other thing is that the sort of Libyan army and police are very weak entities, and therefore there isn't really a sort of state security structure that these groups could even hand over to, even if they did want to.
The UN Special Representative also noted that the 18 March Quartet meeting called for member states to exert their influence with the parties to pull Libya back from the brink and re-engage in the political process. Is the international community capable anymore of exerting any influence to prevent the escalation in Libya?
Yes, I believe it is, because I think the best chance currently that Libya has of de-escalating the situation and finding a way to move forward is to restart the political talks and try to find a power-sharing agreement. And I think the international community, and particularly certain states who have close relationships with rival factions and militias on the ground, do have the ability to exert some influence and de-incentivize the military action. It may not be that they're directly supporting, you know, what is happening on the ground, but if they make it clear that military escalation will mean less support, less funding, less political legitimacy, then I think certainly some of the key, not just Western states, but actually particularly regional states like Egypt and others, can make a big difference in incentivizing the different political and military factions to come again to the table and get political talk started again.
Rhiannon Smith is managing editor of Libya Analysis in London. She spoke to VOA's Mohammed Al-Shinawi. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.